Okay, now I got it. Tana, I'll give it again. Tana and Carol, thank you for your beautiful music and leading us this morning. It's good to see some familiar faces and good to see some visiting faces. And I know Gloria's got a little group here of family. And I've met Lucy and I met Gloria and I know Cheryl, but I haven't met the one next to Cheryl. Tell me your name. Linda. Good to have you with us this morning. Great to have you. I'm not sure what the occasion is, whether it's spring break and you want to get out of Florida, or whether it's Gloria's birthday or Cheryl's birthday, but it's great to have you up here with us today. And we good to all Girl Week. Okay, once a year. Okay. Well, I'm glad that you're all together. And thank you for being in church on Sunday. It's good to see Larry Jr. out there too. And the Darbys and Bevan and Dorothy and everybody. It's good to see you and to hear about this little family here. That's Amber and who else? Preston. Thank you. I met you last week, but good to have you here. I see some other visitors out there, but we'll catch you at the end of the day here. Welcome to those of you who are coming and joining us a long way away. We've got some people in Belgium, some in New Zealand this past week that told me they've been watching, some in Africa. So we may be a small little church, but we've got a wide, worldwide opportunity here through this virtual reality domain. I want to ask you a question. What do you do when the strong person in your life becomes weak? What do you do when the strong person in your life becomes weak? Some of us have already experienced the heartache and the loss of a mom and a dad. Those landmarks in our lives, those pillars that we, as I was sharing with Susan and David yesterday, you long for one more conversation, just one more. That will come in the next life. Mom and dad are in a safe place, in safe hands, eternity with the Lord. But we miss that landmark. We miss that pillar. What do we do when a professor that has tutored us at seminary, who was so wise, a sage, one who had spoken with such clarity and authority, who could have gone to Harvard at 15 years old but never had the financial resources, who's been interested in your life and invested in your life, but you would look down at the hospital bed and he's gasping for breath as the last vestiges of Lou Gehrig's disease are taking his life from you? What do you do when you're in a team? A team and your leader suddenly loses his way and loses his or her confidence. How do you respond? What do you do when your pastor loses his faith, loses his hope, loses the direction of his life? What do we do when people that are strong and people that we have leaned into suddenly seem to be frail or they are gone? What the disciples felt when they experienced Gethsemane with Jesus. This Jesus that Mark brings to us, who walked across the stage of Galilee and Judea like a colossus. This one who came down into the wilderness and was baptized by his cousin, his kissing cousin, John the Baptist, this frontier man. And as the heavens, as Mark gives to us in the text, split apart, was sheared apart, schizomenos. As the heavens were sheared apart and the presence of God was there in this commissioning moment, as Jesus came up out of the water and the Spirit descended upon him like a dove, when the Father could no longer contain his joy but boomed out, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am delighted." And then the Jesus who had now stepped into the public domain, left behind the anonymity of Joseph's shed, left behind that safe place of unknown in Nazareth, and now had come out into the public domain, baptism, and then ministry after the temptation. Now Jesus is going to know the press of the crowd. The paparazzi will be on his heels. He'll be public property. He'll be hemmed in by the crowd and the press of humanity. But this Jesus commissioned and the Jordan River now strikes out into the wilderness, thrown out literally, that's the Greek, thrown out into the wilderness, not because he's resistant, but because he's going into the apocalyptic battle with the evil one. The devil's backyard, the wilderness, the place of loneliness and demons. There for 40 days, Jesus will pray and fast, and he will turn away and deflect the temptations of the evil one. To turn stones into bread. To jump from the temple precipice. And the father would then be blackmailed into catching him. To kneel before the evil one, the ruler of this world, and to have all the domains and the kingdoms of the world, but then to have compromised the cross which lay ahead. This Jesus who comes into Mark's gospel as the Indiana Jones, the man of action, the one who operates immediately. This Jesus who takes that little body of water shaped like a harp, and as the winds come through the valley of the doves and whip it up into a frenzy, he says to the winds, literally the Greek, he muzzles those waters with one word, shut up. Peace, be still, be quiet. And just as he muzzles the waters of that lake, and just as he healed that leper in the Capernaum synagogue, he goes to the other side of the lake, the wrong side of the tracks. And there he finds a Gadarene demoniac living amidst the dead, the cemetery, the ancient psychological ward of that day. And Jesus gives to that one who's fractured and broken identity and symmetry and name and purpose. But then Jesus goes back to the right side of the tracks. He says to that Gadarene demoniac who's now healed, you stay and be missionary among your people. You're an exhibit A of God's power and God's grace. But then he goes back onto the Capernaum side, and Jairus comes running. My 12-year-old daughter is at the brink of death. Come. And Jesus is on his way. And then a woman who's had a uterine hemorrhage for 12 years. She'd gone all the gynecologists she knew, and she was still bleeding. And she touches Jesus' tassels, the zizith of his robe. And with that touch of faith, she is healed. She's allowed to go back to church now. She's not unclean anymore. Jesus frees her, not only physically, but socially, to go back into society. And then he hears that Jairus' daughter is gone. He comes amidst the professional wailings, the noise, the ululating, and he comes and with the three, James and John and Peter, he takes the little elbow of this 12-year-old girl who's dead. And he resuscitates her, brings her back to life. Talitha cum, little girl, little lamb, be awake. This Jesus who goes into the Galilean hillside, feeds 5,000 men with five coarse barley loaves and two little sardine fish, feeds the crowds. This Jesus who goes up into Caesarea Philippi and has a retreat on Mount Hermon, this massive mountain, and there he goes through the transfiguration and comes down from the mountain after God again has spoken. God again speaking in the transfiguration, encouraging Jesus as he's about to descend the mountain and journey 80 miles south to Jerusalem, where he will go outside the city and die. That's the plan. And he makes his way, and he comes in that last week of his earthly life, and we filled in this last week with final moments. The final moment when he goes into that house of God, the temple. But it's been desecrated. Caiaphas and Annas and the bunch of religious thugs have prostituted God's worship for this piety, for profit. They're peddlers of animals for sacrifice. They're exchanging money in the court of the Gentiles. And Jesus, in zeal and jealous for the honor of God, creates bedlam and turns it over. That's his last visit in the temple. He'll have his last sermon, the eschatological discourse in Mark 13. He'll talk about the end of history. And then he will gather with his disciples in the upper room, last meal. And then in that explosive, poignant, emotive moments where raw emotions are there, Jesus will pick up a towel and a basin of water and wash their soiled feet. And then he'll look into their eyes as he continues to teach them in those five chapters of John, in this testamentary legacy of teaching. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. But we're about to see this one who speaks those words, do not be troubled, will be troubled. He goes on to talk about the vine. Reside in me, disciples. I'm the true vine. They listen to his high priestly prayer. That's the Lord's Prayer in chapter 17 of John. And after that last upper meal in the upper room, that meal in the upper room, then we have the final end as we pull the curtains on those little flickering flames of the terracotta lamps in the upper room. For the Jesus who healed and the Jesus who came with such a powerful, provocative message will now take the next step, and he'll walk out into the darkness of the night. And as he leaves the upper room, he will walk up towards, through that Kidron Valley that splices the city of Jerusalem and the Mount of Olives on its east. And as he walks up the Kidron Valley, there is the scudding, the fleet of clouds as they move across the sky. And in between those intermittent clouds, there's silver light. And Jesus, it's Passover, so there are crowds that have camped along the side of the Kidron Valley at the base of the Mount of Olives. And he comes to an orchard of olive trees. There on that outcropping on the bottom part of the Mount of Olives, Jerusalem to its west, but on the eastern side of Jerusalem. And there he stands in Gethsemane. And that's where we pick up our reading this morning. Mark 14. Verse, I want to reach back all the way to 26. After singing a hymn, this is in the upper room. They would have sung the Hallel. At the beginning of a Passover meal, you sing Psalm 113, 114. When the Passover is over, you sing Psalm 115 through 117. After singing those psalms, then we read, they went out to the Mount of Olives. And Jesus said to them, you will all fall away because it is written, I will strike down the shepherd and the sheep shall be scattered. You all will scandalize me. That's what that means. You shall all fall away. You will all desert me. All will desert me. Scandalizo, you will fall away from me. You will desert me. This is a prediction of what is to come in these ensuing moments. The shepherd will be struck down, Jesus. And the sheep shall be scattered. But after I have been raised, I will go ahead of you to Galilee. There's the hope. There's the silver lining. But Peter said to him, even though all may fall away, yet I will not. Typical bravado, Peter. Jesus said to him, truly I say to you that this very night, before a rooster crows twice, you yourself will deny me three times. Peter will not only go to sleep three times in the garden, but he will also deny Jesus three times in the high priest's courtyard. But Peter kept saying insistently, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. And they were all were saying the same thing. All, this cocksure fisherman who's going to betray Jesus. The disciples who, when they came to arrest him after the Garden of Gethsemane, will flee like petrified rabbits into the dark night. What's their mettle? Well, we're about to find out. They cower, they run. Now verse 32. They came to a place named Gethsemane. The only reason we know that's a garden is because when we read John chapter 18, 1, it talks about them going to a garden. A garden where they used to rendezvous often with Jesus and the disciples. And scholars have put together this tradition, the Garden of Gethsemane. And he said to his disciples, sit here until I have prayed. And He took with him Peter and James and John. Look at these words carefully. Began to be very distressed and troubled. And he said to them, "My soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Remain here and keep watch." He went a little beyond them and fell to the ground. Began to pray that if it were possible, the hour might pass him by. And he was saying, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." And he came and found them sleeping. He said to Peter, "Simon, are you asleep? Could you not keep watch for 1 hour? Keep watching and praying that you may not come into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Again he went away and prayed, saying the same words. And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. He came the third time and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? It is enough. The hour has come. Behold, the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up, let us be going. Behold, the one who betrays me is at hand." This is a haunting scene. When I think of Moses at the burning bush in Exodus 3, after 40 years of looking after Jethro's sheep, the father-in-law's sheep in the pastures, he encounters the living God, and God says, "Take your sandals off." I feel like we've got to take our sandals off when we come to this passage. This is a haunting scene, an interplay between the heart of Jesus and the will of God. It's a scene that is filled with emotion, raw emotion, naked vulnerability, as we come to this text. Jesus comes to a garden called Gethsemane. The Hebrew, the Semitic name means the olive press. How fitting. As Jesus will be crushed in this moment of conflict between the obedience to God and the natural inclination to resist what lies ahead. When you come to Gethsemane, we see, as we've done when we've gone to Israel, these massive gnarled trees, hundreds of years old, reaching out into the sky, swollen with breath. These rough, majestic trees that have witnessed history. We cannot tell how old they are without cutting them down and looking at all the bark and the inside parts of the tree. But I've wondered as I looked at this whether these trees in Gethsemane that were there in Jesus' day were witness to 1,000 years earlier when the son of David had fled as king of Israel when Absalom, his son, his own kith and kin were coming to overthrow him. The insurrection, the coup d'etat in 2 Samuel 15:30, David walks through the Kidron Valley, the chilly waters, barefoot, head bowed, covered, weeping, as he goes across through these gardens of olive trees, up to the summit of the Mount of Olives, and out into the wilderness of Judea. I wonder if these Gethsemane trees, columns of witness, had seen the Son of David in a sense, and now hear this one called Jesus open up his heart in brokenness and in agony. Well, this would be the last prayer. We had the last visit to the temple. We had the last sermon. We had the last supper. Now we have the last prayer. And who is part of this? Three that had been with Jesus before. His band of brothers, that inner band of brothers, the James and John, the sons of Zebedee and Simon Peter. They had been with Jesus when he gave life to Jairus' daughter, just the three. They had been with Jesus when he was transfigured, and there was Elijah and Moses. And now they would be with Jesus in this haunting moment of solitude and prayer. In Mark, we find Jesus praying three times. Mark 1:35, Mark 6:46, and in this passage that we've just read, we find Mark setting out Jesus praying in the night. Disciples, come, you three, and stay vigil with me. Watch. Times of crisis, when Jesus goes to the mountain, goes into the night, and prays to his Father. Watch and pray. Look at the mood. We found the place. It's the Garden of the Olive Press. We found the participants. It's the inner three. But what about the mood? Jesus is besieged with intense spiritual affliction. I want to break down these words for you in verse 33 and 34. These are rare, R-A-R-E, rare words in the Greek text. In fact, this one word, the opening word, is only found in Mark's gospel. It's this word, ekthambain. And it has behind it, it reads in my translation, I'm not sure about yours, but verse 33, and he was very distressed. The word there suggests that he was alarmed, that he shuddered with terror. That's the idea of the emotional efficacy and content of what is transpiring here. Horror, alarm at what awaits, shuddering horror. The next word in verse 33, and troubled, adaimonain, distressed, agitated, troubled, perturbed, that's a little light, perturbed. The anxiety is there, and he feels like there's no escape, anguish. And then in verse 34, lest we not see those first two words, here comes the third description. Deeply grieved to the point of death. Paralupsis, burdened with grief. Stretched to the limit is the idea. So we see here the psychological anguish before the physical anguish on the cross. The psychological anguish, for he had come and he had proclaimed the message of the kingdom. But the corrupt religious leadership had thrown it away, and now they were had not only resisted the message, but they were planning to kill the messenger. If that wasn't not enough, his family misunderstood him. His town of Nazareth, his hometown, rejected him. His disciples failed him. Peter denied him. Judas betrayed him. The psychological buildup over the days and months and years. And now he knows that his end is imminent. He's deeply grieved. He collapses on the earth, the garden floor. Doesn't say he even kneels. I can see him stretched out, lying on the garden floor, weeping, praying with anguish. Luke 22, and I think it's 42. I want to check that out. But Luke 22, 42 shows us the anguish of this garden event in Gethsemane. For there we read in this Lucan gospel of the agony that he is experiencing. I want to read it to you. Luke 22, 44. In being in agony, he was praying very fervently, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling down upon the ground. He didn't sweat blood, but it was sweat like blood. His hair plastered against his forehead. The mental and physical and emotional anguish collide together in this moment. No friends, disciples, the inner three that cannot stay awake, and the deafening silence of God. God spoke encouragement after the baptism, before the wilderness experience. God spoke at the transfiguration before his son would journey all the way to Jerusalem and gave us those towering magisterial passion predictions. In Mark 8:31, 9:30, 10:32, the Son of Man will go up to Jerusalem and be killed, and on the third day will be raised again. God spoke twice, but in the garden, God is silent. No voice. The agony. The voice of the Father was not there. It's one thing to hear the voice of God before you go out into the wilderness and into ministry. It's one thing to hear the voice of God and enter the road. It's another thing to hear the voice of God at the transfiguration and to continue down the road. But what do you do when you come to the cul-de-sac, when you come to Gethsemane and there's no voice, dead-end street, and you know what awaits you? And there's anguish. And there's a bitter end. I love to explore cities. And some of you know that I like to go to cemeteries because I like history. But I stumbled across a cemetery outside Wesley's Chapel in London one day with Carol and a couple of our children. And this was a fascinating place to go exploring the cemetery. It was right opposite Wesley's Chapel, and Carol got to play Charles Wesley's organ for a few minutes. They asked for volunteers, and she played it a little bit. But I went into the cemetery. And there I found some of the big names that I didn't even know were buried there. I found the grave of William Blake. I found the grave of Isaac Watts, the English hymnody. I found the grave of John Bunyan, Pilgrim's Progress. And I found the grave of an author of a book I read as a young boy, Robinson Crusoe, Daniel Defoe. Published that on the 25th of April, 1719. If you remember Robinson Crusoe, we had to cut our teeth in the British world on those kind of books. And I remember the story of Robinson Crusoe marooned on a beach. And how when it turned to night on that beach, he would remove himself from the jungle and the thick vegetation on the island. And he would build a fire on the beach and he would huddle around it in the security and the safety of the camp light, of just being on that beach safe. And he would peer into the darkness beyond in the jungle. And icy fingers of terror would cause his soul to shudder when he thought what was in that jungle. In a sense, at Gethsemane, Jesus has stepped beyond the circle of light cast by God's presence into pitch blackness of the jungle of evil. You ask me, how does Socrates face death with equanimity and poise and balance? How do the martyrs of the Maccabees go to their fiery martyrdoms with such poise, and yet we find the Son of God, Son of David, Son of Man, blinking in the Garden of Eden, stepping back from the Garden of Eden? If you go and read Plato's Phaedo, the account of Socrates' death when he's charged with asabia, he's charged with wickedness, of not giving deference to the Greek gods, of being perhaps flirting with Sparta, the rival city, of corrupting the youth of Athens. And found by the Athenian jurors to be guilty, he takes that bowl of hemlock, the cup, interesting, cup of hemlock, and drinks it and walks around until he begins to feel it work its way up, the poison into his body, and lies down. And before it comes up and numbs his heart, he says to his wealthy friend Crito, "We owe a rooster to Asclepius, the god of healing. Please don't forget to pay the debt." What does Jesus fear? The prospect of physical death on a brutal Roman cross? for sure, but that's not why he is balking at the prospect of what awaits him. We know better than that. In the Garden of Eden, he reaches back to the crime of the Garden of Delight. In the Garden of Gethsemane, he reaches back to the Garden of Eden. It's the history of humankind is a tale of two gardens, where there in the Garden of Eden, the original couple snatched at equality with God and derailed the divine enterprise of men and women walking hand in hand and in purpose with God. This is much more than the prospect of his own death. The clue is found for us in the same gospel, Mark 10:45. For even the Son of Man has come not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. There's the objective declaration. To give his life a ransom for many. Here's the subjective experience of that giving his life as a ransom for many. This is the prelude. Forget what's going to happen a few hours later on that hill outside Jerusalem on a mountaintop. The battle is fought in the valley. Jesus will have to crucify his will before his body is crucified hours later on the hill. Jesus will have to live out what Isaiah predicted in 53:5, that he would be crushed for our iniquities, that our transgressions would pierce him. It's enough for you or for me to face our own individual sins, and Christ was sinless, but for Christ who was sinless to take upon his shoulders all of the sin and crimes and evil and cowardice upon his shoulders at Golgotha, that's what he resisted. That's what he shrunk back from. This was solidarity with sinful humanity. He balked at the specter of identifying with sinners, just like you and me. So fully would he identify with sinners that he became the object of God's wrath and punishment against sin. And that prospect was overwhelming. And if you think that there's no crisis here, then hear the fourth word from the cross. Some hours after the Gethsemane anguish, my God, why have you forsaken me? Well, the abandonment begins in the garden. Jesus has to face this apocalyptic war in the trenches of the Garden of Gethsemane. Before the cross, on the hill, there needs to be the surrender in the valley. The surrender takes place not on the hill outside Golgotha, Jerusalem, but in the valley beneath it. The cross is a matter of the heart before it is a matter of the hands. It's a matter of the will before it's a matter of the body being relinquished to the Roman crucifixion guard. Throughout his ministry, Jesus has gone in obedience. He's never taken the no exit or the off ramp. In terms of God's obedience, he's stayed the course. But now, he prays. And verse 36 is where we need to conclude. This is a lament that he prays. Did you know that almost two-thirds of the Psalms are laments? A lament is when the Hebrew or the Jews would cry out to God and say, God, where are you? Step into my world. I've been betrayed by my friends and my confidants, or I'm about to be put to death by my enemies. This is a lament. So he comes with the mood of praying, calling out to God from depth to depth, soul to soul. And his first word is invocation. The Greek in Mark, in fact, in Mark, it gives us, in verse 36, the Aramaic word, Abba. Here we have absolute trust, affection. This is intimacy. This is simplicity. This is boldness. Jesus says, Abba. It was rare for a Jew to refer to God in that way. But he shatters pious custom. This is a son who has consciousness of his father. That's why he's here. That's why he's fulfilling the obedient role and purpose of the father. Abba. Then the Greek word, after the Aramaic, the Greek phrase, pater, father. Aramaic, Abba. Greek, pater. This one will travel through Gethsemane and Golgotha so that we can read, as Paul describes it, we are the adopted sons of God, and we in Romans 8:15 and Galatians 4:6 can cry out, Abba. What intimacy, what simplicity. But the invocation is followed by the petition, by the confession. Here there's a moment of reverence. All things are possible for you. Here's a sinew of faith that burns like a bright candle. All things are possible for you. God, you spoke the universe into being. I was there back in eternity with you. In the beginning was the Word, Logos, and God, Theos. We were together. I know what you can do if you can create the universe. Is there another possibility here? Faith. In this moment of doubt, there's still faith, a sinew of bright faith and hope in the God of Israel. But wait, Jesus. As Colbert said, the ransom has to be paid. The bill, this is what Bart says, the bill, B-I-L-L, is being presented. So we move third to the petition. This moment of shattering request. Remove this cup from me. Remove this cup from me. Will Jesus stumble at the 99-yard line? Some commentators want to read this, and I'm not sure that I go along with them. They argue that Jesus' request, remove this cup from me, is not a contradiction to the purposes of God, but rather expressing and teasing out the full limit of God's purpose. Do you really want me to travel down this path? I see it as much more antithetical and conflictual. Remove this cup from me. God, even as you took Isaac and you held back Abraham's hand in the Akedah, the binding of Isaac on Mount Moriah, God, is there a way that you can stay your hand? Is there an alternative paradigm or model that we can go through? Is there a crossless solution? And heaven paused. What are those magisterial passion claims that he would go up to Jerusalem? Would all the ministry and life of Jesus be compromised at the end here as he balks at the prospect of becoming, not in his being, but in that transaction, having laid upon his shoulders the sin of the world? Is there another way to escape? And he concludes in verse 36 with a statement of submission. Here's the resolution. Here is the recovery. Here is the moment. Yet not what I will, but what you will. In life and in death, Jesus will be obedient to the Father. Choice. Obedience. I will accept the nails of the cross as I accepted the stones in the wilderness. I will see it through. This taps into the deepest current of Jesus' faith in his Father. He will not take the exit ramp. The There's a way that theologians work with this Gethsemane text. And they weave together two aspects, which one will be familiar with you, the other perhaps not. But it's like there's a convergence in this Gethsemane experience of an understanding of this world. And that's the understanding that we would lean towards as evangelicals. That here we have Jesus agreeing to be the substitutionary atonement. He would go and be the substitute, the scapegoat on the cross. And he allows his will to be crucified in Gethsemane before his body, as I've said before today, on the cross. In Gethsemane, that moment when he felt so far from the purposes of God, at that moment of what he perceived as distance from God, he is actually the closest to God in fulfilling the purpose. Not my will, but your will be done. Well, there's a second theological strand here, and I close with this. Some scholars argue that we need to understand apocalyptic thought in this text, Hebrew text, and in Israel. Apocalypse runs like this, apocalyptic thought. Apocalyptic thought that Paul projects in his writings is that the God of Israel will triumph and the God of Israel will be victorious. But what has happened is the cosmic forces of this world, the cosmic forces of this world of evil have ensnared God's good creation. And we see patterns of repetitive sin and death in our world. But through the death and resurrection of Jesus and through the power of his Spirit, there will be victory. And Jesus is part of this agana. Jesus is the combatant. Jesus is in the trenches of warfare against the forces of evil and darkness, cosmic forces. So Gethsemane is the anguish of Jesus before the cross. Jesus beginning, in a sense, the first day of the age to come. This is the beginning of the crucifixion event. What he does in Gethsemane is just lived out in the cross event. The battle is fought in the garden. So my prayer is that as you and I come to this Easter season, we will not be like the disciples who fell asleep. That we will not be lulled to sleep by the familiarity of the story, but we'll read it with fresh eyes, fresh hearts, of the distance that Jesus traveled for you and for me. Let us pray. Father, I hear the words from the Old Testament, obedience is better than sacrifice. But here I hear the words in the New Testament and I see obedience and sacrifice. The obedience of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, who knelt in the upper room, who fell on the earth in the dust of Gethsemane where he was crushed in the olive press. And out of that experience and that anguish came the fruit and the wine of obedience that led to sacrifice on that cross. For you, for me. Father, thank you for the truth of your word. Thank you for the challenge of your word. As we leave here today, maybe you remember the love of the Father and the love of the Son and the Spirit for each one of us. For it's in your name that we pray.